Michael Avery with Classic Business on Classic 1027.
Pick n Pay became the first South African retailer to trial compostable bags as an environmentally friendly alternative to plastic bags. The one-day trial conducted yesterday at its V&A waterfront store was to gauge customer reaction, which will hopefully inform further industry discussions, the retailer says, on alternatives to plastic bags. And that customer trial replaced all plastic carrier bags, barrier bags and fruit and vegetable bags with compostable bags made from starches and cellulose and vegetable oils and all sorts of combinations. Well, this sounds like a good idea on the surface. There are all sorts of issues that one needs to be aware of and consider before going this route, and it's important to always let the science lead the debate. So I've invited Professor Linda Godfrey, manager in the Waste RDI Roadmap Implementation Unit at the Department of Science and Technology, principal scientist for waste for development at the CSIR, and extraordinary associate professor at the Northwest University. That's quite a business card, Professor, to talk about what we should be considering as we search for plastic alternatives. Good evening.
Good evening, and thank you for having me on the show.
Firstly, what is the Waste RDI Roadmap Implementation Unit currently engaged with?
So the Waste RDI Roadmap is an initiative of national government, the Department of Science and Technology, which is aimed at driving research and development in the waste sector, essentially looking at innovative opportunities and alternatives to just sending our waste to landfill.
And what do you make of biodegradable plastic shopping bags as a solution to this plastic waste crisis? Because make no mistake, we are drowning in plastic.
I think absolutely. You know, if you just look at social media over the last year, you'll see this backlash from consumers around plastic, and particularly around plastic into the marine environment. We see these very disturbing images, you know, of whales dying with their stomachs full of plastic, etc. I think that, first of all, you know, I should commend retailers for taking this issue on. Mm. I think they are responding to the pressure that they're feeling from consumers. I do have a concern, though, personally about biodegradable plastic bags. I think there are a number of issues around that. I think, first and foremost, we have to make sure that biodegradable bags are, in fact, a better environmental alternative to what we currently have. And as far as I'm aware, there has not yet been a life cycle analysis done in South Africa of what the most appropriate carrier shopping bag is. And the reason I say this is because, first of all, not all biodegradable shopping bags are necessarily compostable, for example.
Wow.
And not all compostable shopping bags are necessarily compostable in your home composting unit at home. So as consumers, we think we're doing the right thing because now we have this bag that degrades in the environment, but very often it's not as simple as that. And I think we need to have the science to inform this debate.
Because there is a risk here for one of these biodegradable plastic bags ending up in the normal plastic recycling stream and contaminating that stream as well.
I think absolutely. You know, if retailers are going to make the move to compostable bags, everybody's going to have to make that move, because if one of these bags gets in the normal plastic recycling stream, it will compromise that entire recycling batch. If you just think about it, for example, if we're taking those bags and we're turning them into something, let's say it ends up in agricultural piping or in something that's going to come into contact with water, you're now dealing with plant starches that's going to compromise the integrity of that product.
So there is an awful lot to consider here. You mentioned the life cycle analysis that needs to be done. Are you aware of any national project to develop a life cycle analysis in the retail space, which is, let's face it, where most of those single-use carrier bags are used and produced?
I'm not currently aware of one, unfortunately. You know, we see the likes of Spar in the Eastern Cape moving to the paper bags. We see Pick n Pay moving to the compostable bags. I'm not sure if they've done the life cycle analyses themselves, and if they have, I would love for them to share that information with the research community. If they haven't, I would love to engage with them that we actually look at a national study. to get the kind of information we need once and for all to inform this debate.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we need to see here, is both the government sector, private sector, working hand in glove to ensure that we come up with an evidence-based, science-led, long-term solution to the crisis. There's also a question here as to whether or not, and you referenced it right in the beginning, this is the most efficient resource use for developing carrier bags. If you look at it, it's still a very linear sort of take, make, dispose type of model at a time when we're talking about moving towards a more circular economy.
Absolutely. You know, if you think about it, as retailers, they're in the position to change consumer behavior, and it's a very powerful position to be in. And that's why, for me personally, I don't necessarily believe that biodegradable plastic bags are the alternative to what we're currently doing. For me, it would be moving towards multiple use bags, you know, bags that we take in when we go shopping, we use them time after time after time. We're absolutely talking about circular economy at the moment now. And if you think about the biodegradable bag, we're taking natural resources, we're turning them into plastic bags, just so that you can simply take your groceries back home again, and then it ends up in the waste stream. The only difference is, as consumers, we feel better about ourselves, because if it does get into the environment, we believe the impact would be less than the current status quo.
Well, it's obviously a very emotive topic, quite clearly, as you've demonstrated, Prof. It's not a simple decision to make, and one that one hopes, at least now being in the public eye, will open up the space for research institutions such as the CSIR and big retailers with their financial and brand clout to be able to work together to find some kind of long-term sustainable solution. Thanks for your time, Linda. We're going to have to leave it there.
Thank you very much.
That was Professor Linda Godfrey, a manager in the Waste RDI Roadmap Implementation Unit at the Department of Science and Technology, and one of the leading scientists for wasteful development at the CSIR.
Michael Avery with Classic Business on Classic 1027.
Well, 19 extraordinary places were added to UNESCO's World Heritage List this week, including some Buddhist temples in South Korea, the forests and wetlands that form the ancestral homes of the Anishinaabeg people in Canada, as well as the ancient port city of Khal Hat in Oman. But amongst all the congratulations and the mutual backslapping that comes with all of this, there was very little or no serious talk about the implications of climate change, which I found quite interesting. And this comes at a time when we've got the US slowly erasing all mentions of climate change under US President Trump. Well, here in South Africa, we continue to try and take the lead. We've published the long-awaited draft national climate change bill, which sends a good signal, but the devil is always in the details. The Department of Environmental Affairs is driving this with the assistance of the German government, and I'm joined now by two of the lead legal advisors who are advising DEA in drafting the bill, Andrew Gilder, Director of Climate Legal, and Olivia Rumble, also a director of climate legal and a senior lecturer at UCT. Evening, guys.
Evening, Michael. Thanks for having us.
Now, Andrew, the public has until the 8th of August to comment, and I was hoping we'd have a little bit more time to unpack the bill. But if you look through it and through some of the legalese, what I really like about the bill is that it provides for the appointment of a ministerial committee on climate change to be tasked with overseeing the necessary activities across all sector departments and spheres of government, in liaison with provincial committees. And I think this sort of coordination in planning and policy making seems like a step in the right direction, because for so long we've had different government departments with their different constituencies, DMR, DST, DEA, all almost pulling in a different direction. So talk to me about how this bill now tries to create a more coordinated approach.
So thanks for that. I mean, the issue of the challenge that climate governance, or the governance of climate change across government, poses to the state is perhaps the most fundamental governance and administrative challenge that any state or nation state is going to face over the next 50 years. In fact, it's such an issue that Olivia and I put together a book on exactly this issue. Now, what is important to understand is that the structures that you see placed in the bill have been under discussion within the Department of Environmental Affairs for a long time. I mean, the first document that called itself a climate change strategy is dated 2004, and one of the first things it says is that governance of climate change is going to have to happen horizontally across government in a situation where typically government tends to govern in silos. And so here's a very, very interesting opportunity, actually. Flowing from Chapter 3 of the Constitution, which says government should be cooperative, here is the Department of Environmental Affairs, which, let's face it, is not front and center in terms of a hierarchy of departments. It's not Treasury. But it, in fact, is leading the way in an approach to future government that might actually smooth over the cracks between those silos.
And that is fascinating, from a broader government cooperation perspective. Olivia, against that backdrop, the draft bill proposes that within 1 year of the proposed new statute coming into operation, each provincial committee should have conducted a climate change needs and response assessment. What do you envisage that entailing?
Thanks, Michael. I think a lot of provinces have already done different versions of what they interpret to be a response to climate change. Some call it a strategy or a plan or an implementation protocol or things of that nature. We were actually at a public hearing yesterday in the West Cape where the provincial department gave a fantastic presentation of what they'd already achieved to date under the various climate change plans that they developed. So I suppose the challenge will be is to update and harmonize what's already in place across provinces, and for those provinces that don't have, ideally to develop guidelines, usually on what the anticipated impact climate change will be for that particular province, and then to give them quite a large degree of leeway to decide how they would like to respond to that, both in terms of adaptation and mitigation. It'll completely differ between provinces. Some might have coastal management issues, might have biodiversity issues, some have particular health-related concerns because of their locations. So I think the idea is to give provinces and municipalities quite a lot of autonomy to decide how they'd like to respond.
But the good thing is at least they're identifying and mapping some of their risks or their vulnerabilities across the various areas, particular to their geography.
Absolutely. And I think the national department has done an excellent job of trying to especially map some of those issues. At a national level, I mean, the difficulty will be drilling into the detail of what that might look like for each province and municipality and the implications of trying to assess those, so getting in technical expert for that. But I think the message that the department is trying to drive home is that there's a really huge amount of information, not just within the department, but within various institutions across the country. That's been happening over the last couple of years that provinces and municipalities can draw from.
And Andrew, looking at it, there are quite a few other provisions in the bill. We just haven't had enough time. We've really just skimmed the surface. We're talking about determining a national greenhouse gas emissions trajectory, sectoral emissions targets. It all has to do with the allocation of carbon budgets. Clearly, there's some dovetailing here with the carbon tax as well. Where to from here? I believe the DEA is going to be holding a series of provincial workshops, and the comment for the bill closes in August, so I'm sure you'd encourage businesses and all stakeholders to get involved.
Absolutely. I mean, we're actually, Olivia and I are in the third week of a stakeholder procession across the country, so we must have done 10 or so meetings in association with the DEA team on the bill so far. What's really, really important, though, to understand is that although that process has been about engaging with stakeholders and discussing the bill, aspects of the bill with them, it is very, very important for the likes of business or NGOs, civil society, to submit written comments on the bill so that really substantive input can be obtained in relation to some of the more significant legal mechanisms. So one of the most significant being a carbon budget. So if you're an emitting industry, and you think you're going to be subject to a carbon budget, then it is incumbent upon you now to make written input into this legislation.
Well, there we have it. That was Andrew Gilder and Olivia Rumble, directors at Climate Legal and legal advisors to the DEA on the draft climate change bill, which is certainly set to shake things up when it comes to things like carbon budgets, as Andrew alluded to.